The Christian pedigree of Antioch is impressive indeed. Paul and Barnabas had made Antioch their missionary base. Peter and Ignatius had led the church there before dying in Rome. But in the middle of the 4th century, a baby was born in Antioch who would add another gem to the city's crown. This child, named John, was the son of the city's military commander, who died a few months after his son was born. Given the family's noble status, the mother had the resources to pay for the best education. The instructor chosen for the boy was a rhetorician named Libanius, the most famous rhetorician of his day. But by the time John was a teenager, Libanius had to concede that his student had surpassed him in both eloquence and power of persuasion. The pagan professor only had one misgiving about his student. "It is a pity," he remarked, "that the boy is a Christian. Otherwise, he could be my successor." Despite his rosy prospects for success, before the age of 20, John had lost his enthusiasm for a life in law or public service. He had met some hermits outside the city and, inspired by their example, decided to join them. For 4 years, he was mentored by wise, experienced monks. Finally, he set out to live in complete solitude. For 2 years, he practiced extreme self-denial, spending all his time in prayer. However, the severity of his austerities took a toll on his health, and he was forced to return to the city to convalesce. As he was regaining his strength, he was noticed by the bishop, who promptly ordained him to the diaconate. In AD 386, the bishop raised him to the priesthood and assigned him to preach in the most popular church in Antioch. John was about 40 years of age. The following year, Emperor Theodosius, who had to fund a new war to repel an invasion of Italy, increased taxes that already had been a crushing burden to many. A mob in Antioch, furious at the tax increase, defaced the city's statues of the emperor and the imperial family. Theodosius announced his intent to punish the city severely for this outrage. Everyone knew what this could mean. Bloodshed was probable. Total destruction of the city was likely. The bishop immediately rushed to Theodosius's palace in Constantinople to plead for mercy. John was left with the people of the city, who were beside themselves with fear. In the face of impending disaster, he led the people in prayer and preached a series of powerful sermons. In these 21 homilies on the statues, John consoled the people but also upbraided them for the vices that had led to the crisis. Fortunately, he received good news, which he was privileged to announce to the people. The emperor had accepted the town's apology and would relent, canceling the planned punishment. By means of his efforts throughout this crisis, John had won the hearts of the people, and his reputation as a preacher was now soundly established. For the next 10 years, John continued to preach daily in Antioch, sometimes twice a day. Stenographers committed these sermons to writing, and a vast quantity of his work survives today. In fact, we have more writings from John than from any other writer of the early Greek church. One of the most notable themes struck by John is the centrality of the Eucharistic sacrifice in the life of the church. He insisted that the consecrated elements truly become the body and blood of Christ. It is not man who causes what is present to become the body and blood of Christ, but Christ himself, who was crucified for us. The priest is the representative when he pronounces those words, but the power and the grace are those of the Lord. "This is my body," he says. This word changes the things that lie before us. And as the sentence, "increase and multiply," once spoken, extends through all time and gives to our nature the power to reproduce itself, even so, that saying, "This is my body," once uttered, does at every table in the churches, from that time to the present day, even till Christ's coming, make the sacrifice complete. In a Christmas homily, John reminded his hearers that he whose birth is celebrated on this feast is given to them in the sacrament, which therefore must be approached with fear and trembling. "Reflect, O man, what sacrificial flesh you take in your hand, to what table you will approach. Remember that you, though dust and ashes, do receive the body and blood of Christ." John most often preached a series of homilies on given books of the Bible. His sermons on the Psalms are the highlight of his preaching on the Old Testament. His sermons on the Gospel of Matthew form the earliest complete commentary on the first Gospel. But where John shines most is in his work on St. Paul. Nearly half of the writings we have from him were sermons on the writings of the Apostle to the Gentiles. He preached on 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, Titus, and Timothy. But his greatest work of all was on the letter to the Romans, by far the best commentary on this book from the days of the early church. He began and ended his commentary with exuberant praise for this apostle who was truly his model and hero. Though he was born in the city where Paul began his ministry, he had a special devotion to the city where Paul's life ended. He concludes his commentary with this tribute to Rome, the city of both Peter and Paul. "I love Rome even for this, although indeed one has other grounds for praising it, both for its greatness and its antiquity, and its beauty and its populousness, and for its power and for its wealth and for its success in war. But I let all this pass and esteem it blessed on this account, that both in his lifetime he, Paul, wrote to them and loved them so, and talked with them while he was with us, and brought his life to a close there. Wherefore the city is more notable upon this ground than upon all others together. And as a body great and strong, it has as two glistening eyes the bodies of these saints. Not so bright is the heaven when the sun sends forth its rays, as is the city of Rome, sending out these two lights into all parts of the world." John, perhaps, was attracted to Paul most especially because John himself was so much like him, tender, sincere, yet fiery, even severe at times. He was as bold as Paul in calling out sin and challenging people to change. His preaching, like Paul's, was eminently practical. Though a monk and committed to an intense life of prayer and self-denial, he was uncommonly in touch with the challenges and temptations of the everyday life of the lay people to whom he preached. Though celibate, he highly prized marriage and family life and devoted much of his preaching to the subject. He recognized that many mores of his society regarding marriage, love, and family were contrary to Christian values. A double standard existed for men and women regarding marital fidelity. Sexual abuse of female slaves by their masters was an accepted occurrence. Wedding receptions, even of Christians, often featured drunkenness, bawdy shenanigans, and hymns in honor of the pagan goddess Aphrodite. John was not afraid to confront these established features of the culture of the day and challenge people to abandon them and create a new, authentically Christian culture of love, marriage, and family. This ruffled feathers then, as such an appeal would do today. John responded to those who thought he was being unreasonable. "I know that some people think I am burdensome and difficult, giving advice like this and uprooting ancient custom. But I do not care at all about their objections. I don't seek your favor, but your benefit. I don't ask for the applause of praise, but the profit of wisdom. Let no one tell me that this is the custom. Where sin is boldly committed, forget about custom. If evil things are done, even if the custom is ancient, abolish them. If they are not evil, even if they are not customary, introduce them and establish them." While John was exercising his priestly ministry in Antioch, things were changing in the imperial city of Constantinople. The council that had met there in AD 381 had passed a law, vastly increasing the influence of the bishop of the new capital, making him first in honor among Eastern bishops, a patriarch, second only to the Pope in Rome. The bishops of the historic Christian centers of Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem had special status, officially recognized by the First Council of Constantinople in 381, and subsequently came to be referred to as patriarchs. Gregory Nazianzen had resigned his post as the city's bishop, so Emperor Theodosius chose an officer in the imperial bureaucracy to replace him. Nectarius was a good man, but a mild and rather unremarkable successor to the great Gregory. Theodosius also had a lackluster successor. When he died in AD 395, his son Arcadius, a shy and somewhat spineless boy of 18, took over to rule the East. In AD 398, the Patriarch of Constantinople died. Arcadius was advised to make the now famous preacher of Antioch the new Patriarch of Constantinople. John was not interested, so the emperor arranged for him to be, as it were, kidnapped and brought to Constantinople. When John arrived, he submitted to the wish of the youthful emperor and was consecrated bishop of the city. John was taken aback at the laxity that he found among the clergy and high-ranking laity who filled the imperial court. He cut down the lavish spending of the bishop's household, abolishing the practice of his predecessor of treating the clergy and prominent laity to elegant banquets. In one of his sermons, John indicated that there were about 100,000 Christians in the imperial city and over 50,000 people living in poverty. He was aghast at the great disparity between the haughty lifestyle of the wealthy Christians and the destitution of so many of their fellow Christians. Some of the wealthy were happy to give a chalice or marble statue to the church, but would never think of donating food or medical care to the poor. Again and again, John addressed the issue of almsgiving in his sermons. "Do you want to honor Christ's body? Then do not scorn him in his nakedness, nor honor him here in the church with silken garments while neglecting him outside where he is cold and naked. For he who said, 'This is my body,' and made it so by his words, also said, 'You saw me hungry and did not feed me,' and inasmuch as you did not do it for one of these, the least of my brothers, you did not do it for me. Let us learn, therefore, to be men of wisdom and to honor Christ as he desires. For a person being honored finds greatest pleasure in the honor he desires, not in the honor we think best. Peter thought he was honoring Christ when he refused to let him wash his feet. But what Peter wanted was not truly an honor, quite the opposite. Give him the honor prescribed in his law by giving your riches to the poor, for God does not want golden vessels but golden hearts." The year after John arrived in the city, there was a major uproar in the palace. Though the young Arcadius was technically emperor, the real power behind the throne had been his chief advisor, Eutropius. However, someone within the palace accused Eutropius of a treasonous plot, and Arcadius was persuaded to have him executed. Soon after, the emperor's young but strong-willed wife, Eudoxia, gave herself the title Augusta, the female form of Augustus. Next, she began wearing the purple vestments of an emperor. Her image even began to appear on coins minted in Constantinople. Everyone knew that this vain woman was now the real power behind the throne and had probably been the one behind the execution of Eutropius. The elite of the city pandered to her conceit and avoided crossing her at any cost. The emperor's right-hand man had evidently gotten in her way and paid for it with his life. Bishop John was not about to be intimidated by this display of ruthlessness. God had brought him to Constantinople because the city needed reform, and he would not back down. In light of the needs of the poor and the vanity of the rich, John took aim at luxury while preaching on one of Paul's letters. "Do you delight in expensive clothes or golden jewelry? Remember Paul's bonds, and these things will seem to you as more worthless than a prostitute's filthy rags or a handful of withered grass. Do you spend long hours adorning your hair and painting your face with cosmetics, hoping to make yourself beautiful? Think of Paul's squalor in prison, and you will burn with desire for his beauty. You will then consider worldly beauty to be ugly, and will bitterly long to share Paul's chains. Think of his face streaming with tears. Day and night, for 3 years, he never ceased his weeping. Imitate his weeping. Make your face bright with tears. Weep for your sins, your anger, your loss of self-control, your love of revelry. Imitate Paul's tears, and you will laugh to scorn the vanities of this passing life. Christ blessed these tears when he said, 'Blessed are you that weep now, for you shall laugh.' Nothing is sweeter than these tears. They are more to be desired than any laughter. Pray earnestly for these tears, so that when others sin, your heart may be broken for them." The common people cheered such preaching and loved their new patriarch. But many among the clergy and privileged classes resented him and resisted his call to reform. Some whispered in the ear of the empress that John's railing against women's adornments were directed at her. She was not amused. She needed to find an episcopal ally to take John down and was pleased to find one in the Patriarch of Alexandria, Theophilus. Prior to the Council of Constantinople, Alexandria had been the greatest Christian see after Rome. the great city of origin, and Athanasius was now playing second fiddle to a city that had been no more than a fishing village 70 years earlier. Constantine, in 330, moved his capital from Nicomedia to a rather insignificant town strategically located on the Bosphorus, the strait between the Black Sea and the Sea of Marmara. The town, formerly known as Byzantium, was renamed Constantinople. The Eastern Roman Empire from this time is hence referred to by historians as the Byzantine Empire. Hence, the Bishop of Alexandria already had a reason to resent the Patriarch of Constantinople. Theophilus's dislike of John turned to rage when he received a summons to Constantinople to answer charges that he had unjustly excommunicated a group of Egyptian monks. Since John was the chairman of the inquiry, Theophilus blamed John for the whole thing and vowed to turn the tables on him. Eudoxia met with him and gave him the opportunity to do so. The next year, the empress filed 29 trumped-up charges against John and invited Theophilus back to be his judge. When John refused to appear before this kangaroo court, he was deposed and ordered into exile. His people were wild with outrage. The day before he departed for exile, he did his best to comfort his grieving people. "The waters have risen, and severe storms are upon us, but we do not fear drowning, for we stand firmly upon a rock. Let the sea rage, it cannot break the rock. Let the waves rise, they cannot sink the boat of Jesus. What are we to fear? Death? Life to me means Christ, and death is gain. Exile? The earth and its fullness belong to the Lord. The confiscation of goods? We brought nothing into this world, and we shall surely take nothing from it. I have only contempt for the world's threats. I find its blessings laughable. I have no fear of poverty, no desire for wealth. I am not afraid of death, nor do I long to live except for your good. I concentrate, therefore, on the present situation, and I urge you, my friends, to have confidence. Do you not hear the Lord saying, 'Where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in their midst'? Will he be absent then, when so many people united in love are gathered together? I have his promise. I am surely not going to rely on my own strength. I have what he has written, that is my staff, my security, my peaceful harbor. Let the world be in upheaval. I hold to his promise and read his message. That is my protecting wall and garrison. What message? Know that I am with you always until the end of the world. If Christ is with me, whom shall I fear? Though the waves and the sea and the anger of our princes are roused against me, they are less to me than a spider's web. Indeed, unless you, my brothers, had detained me, I would have left this very day. For I always say, Lord, your will be done, not what this fellow or that would have me do, but what you would have me do. That is my strong tower, my immovable rock, my staff that never gives way. If God wants something, let it be done. If he wants me to stay here, I am grateful. But wherever he wants me to be, I am no less grateful." The next day, John was gone, but not for long. That night, an earthquake rocked the imperial city, and Eudoxia saw it as a warning from on high. She immediately petitioned her compliant husband to bring John back. So exactly one day after he departed, the beloved bishop returned to town, and the whole city went out to welcome him. The favor of the vain empress lasted only a short while. 2 months later, she had a silver statue of herself erected directly in front of John's cathedral. The dedication celebration deteriorated into raucous revelry and disrupted the divine liturgy that was taking place inside the cathedral. John could not remain silent in the face of this sacrilege, so a few days later, on the feast of St. John the Baptist, he thundered from the pulpit. "Again Herodias raves. Again she is troubled. She dances again and again desires to receive John's head on a platter." John received a decree from the emperor disbarring him from preaching and celebrating the liturgy. He paid no heed. Next, he was forbidden to even set foot in a church building. He nevertheless continued to carry out his ministry. On Holy Saturday Eve, as he baptized new Christians at the Easter Vigil, troops broke into the church and mixed blood with the baptismal water. The frail old bishop found himself brutally dragged into remote exile in easternmost Turkey. Within a few months, the empress died from complications following childbirth. She was not yet 30. For the next 2 years, John, though broken in health, was comforted in his exile by a steady stream of pilgrims who had traveled all the way from Antioch to pay homage to one they considered a living saint. Fearful of John's influence over these visitors, the emperor in AD 407 determined to completely isolate him in the remote territory east of the Black Sea. But John's health finally gave out, and he died on the way. His last words were, "Glory to God for all things." Before he was sent off into his final exile, John had managed to send a letter of appeal to Rome. The Pope wrote to the devious Bishop of Alexandria stating that he did not accept the removal of John from his see. He demanded a synod be held with representatives from both East and West so that John's case could be impartially reviewed. When Bishop Theophilus refused, the Pope excommunicated him as well as John's successor in Constantinople until such time as John's name was cleared and he was restored to a place of honor in the Eastern churches. Meanwhile, the popularity of this prophetic patriarch who had stood up to Jezebel increased day by day. His sufferings and unjust death only heightened his authority in the eyes of the people. The hapless Emperor Arcadius died only a few months after John. 30 years later, John's remains were brought back to Constantinople in solemn procession. The new emperor, Theodosius II, son of Eudoxia, laid his head on the casket and begged forgiveness for the sins of his parents. John was buried in the Church of the Holy Apostles, next to the remains of Saints Andrew, Luke, and Timothy, and Emperor Constantine. John was later recognized as one of the three holy hierarchs of the Orthodox Church and, similarly, by Catholics as one of the four greatest doctors of the Eastern Church. Due to his great devotion to the sacrament of Christ's body and blood, he is also referred to by many in the West as the Doctor of the Eucharist. Within a century, an epithet was given him that has all but replaced his proper name. Acknowledging him as the greatest popular preacher of the East, it calls him Chrysostom, meaning golden-mouthed. To this day, the predominant liturgy celebrated in Eastern churches, both Orthodox and Catholic, is known as the Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom.